so-called loopholes, many of these exemptions, I think you'll admit, are in all equity and fairness good exemptions.
And we have not had any of them. Only this, that the personal exemptions are, there are a lot of loopholes, or let's call them special tax preferences that we could nicely do without and take out the dividends in
the
form of lower rates. Well, there's some of the things that the president has now recommended be changed. We're losing $500 million and then some of tax revenue on interest and dividends. Because
well, that's evasion. That's sheer evasion. That's a loophole.
It's a loss of tax revenue.
That ought to be. I'm talking about...
Let's take the business expense allowances, for example. There's another case. And there's some capital gains and so forth. If you could just put that back into that base...
Would you move on payment expenses as a concept, Mr. Chairman?
Well, I'd certainly cut them down awfully sharply. As the president said, I think the term "it's deductible" should go out of our business
language. Would you cut them down by law or by administration?
Well, I don't care which way it's done. Just to cut them to
the
reasonable
law should
limits.
Be sufficient today to give us an equitable arrangement on
Gentlemen, I'm sorry. I must interrupt. You'll return after this important announcement. Thank you very
much. A monthly discussion of the great questions facing our country is presented as a public service by the Reader's Digest in association with the Freedoms Foundation at Valley Forge.
With some of our neighbors across the sea and with juvenile delinquency at home and so forth, we're seeing a parade that is made up of hundreds and hundreds of young people who certainly aren't delinquents. Their people at home must be very proud of all these young people.
I'm sure they are, Ronnie. Heading our way down the parade route of this 73rd annual Tournament of Roses, the winner of the national trophy from St. Louis, Missouri, the Ways of Old Holland. A 17-foot cheese barge on the other side of the float, bringing cheese down to the market in Holland. A deck and a driver standing on the deck, holding his team of 8 of the famous Clydesdale horses, each horse wearing a blanket of 1,250 blooms of daffodils. The daffodils, the tulips, were flown directly from Holland over the polar route. The driver, by the way, Walter L. Brody, particularly skilled, of course, in this craft, it is a craft, has taken years of training. He has a rein for each horse. Truly an unusual skill. There's the barge over there with the lovely Dutch girl and the bowls of Edam cheese, the deck covered with tulips, red, yellow, and pink.
You know, Bess, if I could interrupt, the reason he's standing there in the tulips while the barge is over at the side, to those of our members too young to remember the days of barges, that's the way it operated. The barge floated, but the driver walked along on the shore.
That's right. Aren't these horses magnificent? Look at them. Do you know that they're 17 hands high, and, Ronnie, they weigh over a ton each? Something like over 2,000 pounds each.
Look, you don't have to tell me this. I'm sorry that they invented trucks. I think we should still all be riding horses.
There's the windmill. Look at the beautiful, giant, rotating windmill. The mill is made of green leaf. The vanes are white mums trimmed with red carnations. So realistic.
And, of course, like so many animated, and what mechanics that takes to animate these things.
Indeed. This is really the only unit moved by real horsepower, huh?
Yes.
Right behind Marshal Doc Vale, an octogenarian. Wish we could get a close look at Doc Vale. There he is. He is 87 years old. Isn't he fantastic? From Baldwin Park, California. Leading his equestrian unit. Some of the folks from San Bernardino, California, all dressed in Western costume. Each silver mounted. Those mountings, by the way, cost quite a few dollars, like $5,000 or $10,000. And now, from Southgate, California, the fable of Greece. This is? Yes. Southgate. Look what happened. another one being towed. I think this is the first time in several years that there have been floats towed. Of course, they're all built with a special towing attachment in the front just in case something like this happens. I was always worried that what they do is tow them off the parade ground, but they don't. They keep them right inside. But we can get a real close look now at the fables of Greece, beautiful Aphrodite, the Greek goddess of love, reclining there on the garden, surrounded by two handmaidens. The ruins of a Grecian temple, done in stock and carnations and mums. And in the back, the spreading tree. Graceful peacocks, whose snow-white down is done in white chrysanthemums. From Southgate, California.
Incidentally, Bess, this might be a good time with that National Guard jeep pulling that to say that another of the requirements in the floats is that every float is so constructed that there is a trailer hitch on the front to specifications so that this very calamity can be undone as easily as possible when it comes along.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you know who this is coming down here now?
I sure do. Marshal John Russell, riding his horse, John Henry, and Peter Brown, riding Latigo. Is that the way?
That's right.
Latigo.
Yes.
By the way, Latigo was ridden by Clark Gable in his last picture of the Misfits.
These are the men from The Lawman.
From television's Lawman. You can hear the cheering and whistling of the crowd because they recognize these boys.
Yes.
There it goes. Television fans seated in the grandstands on this beautiful sunny day in Pasadena. The weather just couldn't be more magnificent. You know, we've, I guess in 73 years, there's only been rain 7 days, and then only three times on the day of the parade itself.
That's right. And you know, it's just, here comes the beautiful float, ladies and gentlemen, of the state of Washington, honoring, of course, the marshal of the parade, Governor Rossellini. This is called Roses of the World. And it's symbolic of the World's Fair to be held this summer in Seattle, the 1962 Seattle World's Fair. And that tower you see there is a replica of the 40-story Needle, which will be part of the fair with a revolving restaurant on top. That's what the cap of this is. Of course, this particular thing here is only 17 feet high. That's the limit in the float so that they can get under the cables and the lines along the route of march. This float is about 57 feet. They allowed them to overhang a couple of feet. A beautiful tribute to the fair with 50 bouquets of red roses, symbolic of all the 50 states. And here is a marching band that has come to us from all over the world. This is the Independent Order of Foresters, Robin Hood Band, under the direction of David Baskerville, making its fourth appearance in the parade. They have 60 regular members, but 44 guest members from the United States, Canada, Mexico, and Western Europe, and now let's listen. A very beautiful float from Market Basket Stores, the Magic Carpet, and of course it's very obvious. You can see there the beautiful carpet. Incidentally, that carpet is inlaid in a complete Persian carpet design, and look at the heads turned on the two sheets riding along there.
You have your choice, a blonde or a brunette.
And behind it, of course, you can see the Temple of Bay. Well, and look at, say, you know, they ought to pick up some hitchhikers there on that magic carpet, because those girls are left down when the clouds beneath the flying magic carpet. But they have mosques and spires of pom-poms and carnations. It's lavender and gold and maroon and of course, a sort of off-white from all of the chrysanthemums. Spanish costumes, riding, of course, as you could imagine in those costumes, palominos, and look at the silver work we see in all of that. Beautiful costumes. Incidentally, she is riding side saddle.
From Montebello, California, celebrating the happy union with sister city Ashiya in Japan that took place in May of this year, a float called the Bridges of Friendship. great expanse of yellow chrysanthemums and bright decoration of red and white carnation. There's a Japanese fantasy tree in the front made of Vanda orchid. And in the back, a Japanese tea house of red and white strung carnations. Miss Montebello, Isabel Rodriguez, sits in the tea house. Two of her princesses attired in Western gowns and the other two in formal Japanese dress. The bridges of bronze chrysanthemums connect an island. And on the island, pool of Cattleya orchids sunk in a bed of yellow roses. The girls seem to get prettier every year, Ron. You should have been saying that, but they do, and younger.
It could be. You know, this is always a great spectacle, though. You just feel like three cheers for all the people who put their talents together to create it.
I agree. And you know, this is the same feeling I get when I visit a company like Quaker Oats. Just before I left there.
It's Ronald Reagan and Bess Morrison describing the Rose Parade of 1962 at Pasadena, California.
From Torrance, California, Torrance by the Sea. Proudly displaying the newly adopted symbol of the city, the seahorse, that zigzags along our parade route. The elf in a high gold mum hat with a red poinsettia shirt, still smiling there. And a giant seahorse of white chrysanthemum.
Oh.
You hear them? The U.S. Marine Corps Band.
When they go by playing that music, I wish we were piping this over to Nikita. And here comes the float from the Union Oil Company of California. It's called Enchanted Traveler. And, of course, it explains itself. There, winding down into the foreground, is the path for the traveler. And underneath those beautiful green and lavender trees is our traveler walking along. You can see that he's animated. But he's very well animated because...
Who's doing that?
Concealed in the trees is a puppeteer. He actually is a history teacher from your high school, John Zuiers. And he has a couple of students helping him, but he has one of the world's great collection of puppets. This is his hobby. And he's riding through the entire parade, concealed up in the trees, and the three of them are manipulating this traveler so that he walks down that bed of pink and white camellias, orchids, and carnations. Him, head turns, the arms and legs move. This, again, is a float that is just sheer beauty. A few times there, the puppeteers have actually managed to have him in tempo, marching in step with that music of the Marine Band which just preceded them. And now behind them is coming some well-known people here from the television show Wagon Train. John McIntyre, Terry Wilson, Frank McGrath, Scott Miller, all in the costumes they wear in Wagon Train. No fancy trappings here. These are cowboy working clothes. Look at him. I'm sure these people are familiar to millions and millions of people who are looking in, and rightly so. And this beautiful float coming up is the city of Minneapolis. This is its first participation, and Minneapolis, of course, is again heralding the idea of the sports that are available, the lakes, the land of lakes. They have the sailboats there sailing into the foreground, and behind them we see the Aquatennial. Minneapolis presents its Aquatennial Queen of the Lakes, Pamela Jo Albinson, a lovely girl, very charming girl, and behind her you see the, done in flowers, the skyline of the city of Minneapolis. This entry was sponsored by the Aquatennial Association, the Downtown Council, and the Chamber of Commerce of the City of Lakes. The water on which the boats are sailing is uniquely created with candy tufts and delphinium, and actually here has a very realistic water effect. And of course, lovely ladies are riding in all of the sailboats, followed by swans, A beautiful float.
And fellas. Lovely ladies followed by swans and fellas.
Where are the fellas?
No, I'm kidding.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Look,
and I didn't
Altadena,
get it.
California, trying to prove that the world was really square. How about that? We see that high-castled Portuguese galleon of Yau Mums tottering on the end of a square world. And there's Bullwinkle, the TV cartoon character, pointing ahead. There he is, saying the world is square. Columbus was all wrong. Of course, the queen and court of the city of Altadena sit on the billowy clouds, waving greetings to the folks here watching our tournament of roses parade.
Incidentally, you know there's one trophy yet to come through we haven't seen, and it's the big one, the sweepstakes.
Right.
Every other trophy has been awarded, and we've seen it so far.
It's going to be an exciting one to see which float does get it.
It'll be funny if they saved it to last. Oh, that's a very clever float. The SS Bullwinkle, the name of the ship.
But, speaking of Columbus, appropriately, we have an equestrian unit led by Marshal Mrs. Carthleen Sent with horses that are supposedly direct descendants of the royal horses of Spain during the time of Isabella, when Columbus discovered America.
Well, that's where a great...
From the bakery and confectionery workers, Northern Wonderland. Look, a real ice skating rink. A setting for a pair of graceful skaters, Lou DeGrotto. Look at them, they're going
swift.
By the way, that ice is frozen the day before and constantly refrozen by a compressor motor. That's what a fella told me. He told me it works like a giant refrigerator. That little girl is the daughter of this lovely lady, Joni McCosker. Northern Wonderland. Isn't it beautiful? Oh, so many pink and white and lavender flowers and chrysanthemums. And the lovely queen. Isn't she beautiful? Say,
just think, an entire freezing unit on there to make that skating possible.
You know, Ronnie, if I could get this beautiful flower arrangement from the Quaker Oath Company, I'd root Marshal Bob Howell on Arabian horses, with trappings all beautiful silver saddles. You know something interesting? That back in 1893, Ronald, women riders on horseback startled the crowd by wearing culottes. You know what they are, the...
Oh, yeah, divided...
black-like skirts. And then, of course, the question was raised as to whether it was ladylike to ride a horse by straddling it, because you mentioned before that one of the ladies was riding side
saddle. That's right, the one in the Spanish garb. And here is a float, the California State Exchange Clubs, and it's a fitting title and a fitting thing for them to do. The title of this float is Round Trip 50 Cents, and you can see the change. The monkeys are sending people up. That's a space vehicle made out of white chrysanthemums, stands on a launching platform of bronze mums, and under this pay, you see the monkeys getting ready to send them up. Only 50 cents. Winnie Neal is the girl that's about to step into the rocket, if she can get up her nerve, because the motive power, if we could pan those cameras down, you will see the motive power is really something. It's a giant firecracker, and one of the chimps is down there in front, all ready with the match to light it and set her off. By the way, the national president of the Exchange Clubs, Judge Frederick W. Howell, is here in our distinguished visitor stand. He's from Dayton, Ohio. You can see the symbol up on the side of the spacecraft. But this is really an exchange. And you know, maybe this is a pretty good idea.
And you know, that fellow from Cal Poly is going to be very happy when he finds that they've shot that pretty girl up to the moon.
Yeah, say, this is going to be all right for the two of them, isn't it? Well, we were talking about something. And I believe it's coming down here. First of all, there is another equestrian unit, but just behind it. This is, again, early California Spanish, and again, it's side saddle. Clyde Gehring is the marshal from San Canyon, Saugus, California, riding Prince Golden Boy. And there it is, the one we've been waiting for. Beth, this is the sweepstakes winner. San Diego City and County, and the title of the float is Polynesia, And believe me, this one is animated. Down here as we land on this Polynesian island at the beginning, there's the outrigger canoe. But look what's going on behind the outrigger canoe. The hula. And if the Tahitian variety of the hula, I might add, the five people riding this float are all, or each one, from a different one of the Polynesian islands. Look at that Tahitian hula they're doing.
This float really has motion.
Yes, it does.
Oh, boy.
And look at the little child that is looking down from the pagoda watching all of this. Not at all interested in the hula. Do you suppose with 5 miles of the parade to go that those two keep that up, that dance all the way for the 5 miles? You know they will. The drums, you can hear them down here. The crowd is yelling, go, go. This is the sweepstakes winner. This is the big winner of the parade, the one you wait for, San Diego City and County.
Right behind them, Hal Malaika Shrine Float.
Yes, that's...
From the Al Malaika Temple, the open heart, very sentimental, very beautifully done, in bronze, white, and red mouth. There's the huge open heart and potentate J.B. Finney sitting there with a young lad, of course symbolizing the devoted work of the shrine for children and particularly for crippled children. A hemisphere of white mums, stripes of bronze and red, showing the five areas of the world, and there in the open heart, our potentate. El Cajon Valley High School Band from El Cajon, California. Their top honor winner band in most of the events they participate. Let's listen. And here from our vantage point, high above the reviewing stands, where we told you you could see it first on CBS, and you certainly have, coming into view, is the float from Redondo Beach, California, King Harbor, the name of the boat harbor in Redondo Beach, resplendent in yellows and oranges and lavenders, very generous use of chrysanthemums. There's a multicolored fish of gold, lavender, and white mum. And his eyes, I think, are rolling a little bit over there.
Yes, they
are. Are they?
Yes.
Miss Redondo, astride our fish, lovely bathing beauty, holding the harness. And the waves of lavender and white mums in stock. And there are two water skiers being towed on a garland of flowers. They're Mexican girls, by the way, from La Paz. Thousands of dazzling blossoms in the sunburst that holds a giant boat in the center, symbolic of King Harbor.
Oh, and here, ladies and gentlemen, is the Girl Scouts float, celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Girl Scouts, telling their entire story, a worldwide salute with the girls from all over the world. And incidentally, Girl Scouts from all over the world, literally and all over the country, sent the flowers, some sent from Hawaii. There's a brownie on the front, the wings denote the rise of the Brownie Scout at age of 10 to the full Girl Scout. There is a scroll and then rising up to the Girl Scout at the back. A very beautiful float and to certainly a very worthwhile cause. And they are followed by the last unit of the parade. Ladies and gentlemen, the Waters family of Compton, California. Kenneth Waters is Marshal. His entire family, wife and daughters and sons, riding black and white pintos, bringing up the rear of the parade down there. Followed, of course, by all the officials and the moving crowd.
You know, in case you're wondering how this parade area, including the stands, of course, is going to be cleaned up, the Pasadena Beautiful Foundation has organized Teenage Cleanup Squadron. That's what they're called, Cleanup Squadron. And they are dressed in colorful, whimsical costumes. We saw them, Ronnie and I did, when we were driving up quite early this morning. And even now, they're circulating throughout the parade area, reminding the people as they leave to clean up their litter as they go. And it's a wonderful reminder for all of us around the nation for the nationwide program of Keeping America Beautiful.
And ladies and gentlemen, we have some visitors who just dropped up here as the parade came to a close. Bess and all of our visitors and our guests on the air, we would like to have you meet from our own state of California, Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, Earl Warren.
How do you do, Ronald?
We're certainly very happy you could be here. And would you introduce here, as a host from California, our distinguished visitor?
I'd be very happy to, Ronald. This is Dr. Wilson, the president of the University of Minnesota, and he tells me that his team is not going to be too rough on us today. Doctor?
A happy New Year to you, Chief Justice, and a happy
thank
New Year
you.
To you, Mr. Regan.
Thank you very much.
Happy New Year to the world in flowers.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you, and we're very happy that you could be up here with us. As a matter of fact, you know, we had another Meredith Wilson around here. Happens to be a fellow from Iowa.
I had lunch with him yesterday.
Oh, wow. Wonderful. I didn't know when they said Meredith Wilson whether you changed a lot or whether the... And I discovered there were two Meredith Wilsons. Well, we're very happy.
It's been a perfect day. It's been a great parade. You couldn't imagine any way it could have been improved. Happy New Year to everybody.
And thank you very much for coming up here, both of you gentlemen. Well, there it is, ladies and gentlemen. The 1962 Tournament of Roses Parade. And what you're hearing now, of course, is the stir of the crowd getting ready to leave, filling the streets and so forth. The burst of applause you heard was for Tail End Charlie, the last unit in the Great Parade. But it's also the crowd's way of thanking all those who made this possible. The thousands of people who worked so hard during the year to keep the Tournament of Roses the spectacle that it is.
That's true, Ronnie. And the 2 hours of beauty and pageantry, the almost 2 hours that we've just seen, actually represent more than 50,000 man-hours of volunteer labor, not even counting the time spent by professional float builders. It's been this volunteer spirit, a kind of miracle of civic pride here in Pasadena, that has made the Tournament of Roses grow from a few flowered carriages and bicycles in 1890 to the magnificent event we've just seen.
Of course, this parade is far from over. The units that you saw some 2 hours ago are only just now reaching the end of the five-mile line of march. There, the float units will be directed to the post-parade display area where they'll be parked for 3 days. And during those days, the beauty of the flowers will be enjoyed by additional thousands of people.
And also waiting at the end of the parade route is a hot lunch for the 3,000 people who took part in it. It's provided by the Tournament of Roses Association. And it is, I guess, Ronald, the only material compensation that anyone receives for participating in the parade. But I'll bet it's worth $1 million after that five-mile ride.
Yes, it is. You know, Bess, a moment ago you mentioned the growth of this annual event from its inception in 1890. Well, nothing could illustrate that growth better than this. The original invitation issued in December 1889 by Dr. Charles Frederick Holder, the man who started all this. To the residents of Pasadena that year, he wrote, "Ladies and gentlemen, are requested to bring with them to the park on New Year's Day all the roses possible so that strangers and tourists may have the benefit of our floral display." Well, 2,000 people showed up that first day, and they've been coming by the millions ever since.
That's true, Ronnie. And what's wonderful is that though the Tournament of Roses has become a giant affair over the years, the people who built it never lost sight of Dr. Holder's original purpose, so that strangers and tourists may have the benefit of our floral display. In that sense, I guess nothing has changed since 1890. And I'm sure Dr. Holder would be proud of the great tradition he left behind him.
Well, I guess our time is about almost up. We're supposed to hurry it along now as the people are hurrying home. It's been a great pleasure sharing this parade with you and with our audience.
Same here, Ronnie. And by the way, there's a lot more happening on CBS during the rest of this eventful New Year's Day, including the Cotton Bowl from Dallas, Texas. So be sure to stay tuned.
Time to say goodbye from Pasadena, California, and let CBS move across the nation. Thank you for being with us, ladies and gentlemen. And may we say once again, from me, Ronald Reagan.
And from me, Beth Meyerson.
And from the makers of Quaker Oats.
Communication with accurate information regarding the activities of your legislators has prompted a group of local citizens to sponsor a daily 5-minute radio program during the noon hour, bringing you the comments of members of the minority party from this area. Feeling that one of the important functions of a minority party is to act as a balance wheel on the activities of the administration, it will be our aim to point out what we feel are fallacies and deficiencies in administration policy. We will offer our views and proposals for alternate policies and new ideas and proposals for the orderly, practical courses of action toward a better state. In review, I think it would be a good idea to examine the alignment of the present legislature and the status of bills introduced last session and carry over to this session for action. In the Senate, there are 13 Democrats, the majority, and 7 Republicans, the minority. In the House, there are 22 Democrats, the majority, and 18 Republicans, the minority. While a greater number of Republicans were elected from the centers of Anchorage and Fairbanks in the last election, the Democrats are still in the majority and have control of the House and the Senate, which is the obvious reason for the choice of a name for this program, the Minority Report. There are 10 standing committees in both the House and the Senate in which the important research and discussion is done prior to debate and final action in formal session. Assignment of individual legislators to these committees was determined by the majority party during the opening days of the last session, and these assignments will carry over to this session, allowing the legislature to immediately get to work on carryover bills. These committees are presided over by a chairman of the majority party and have anywhere from 5 to 11 members each, most legislators serving on more than one committee. We will bring you information on important committee work on a later program. A review of work from last session shows a total of 463 bills introduced in the House and Senate. 147 were passed, 36 of these failed to pass or were vetoed, and 280 are carried over for action in this session. Some of these, however, will never be considered because of various reasons. Some will be withdrawn by their authors, some will have lost their timeliness, and others will not receive any committee consideration. So much for the organization and work ready to be done. All legislators are anxiously awaiting the state of the state and budget messages from the governor. The reaction to these messages by the governor will vary a great deal with individual legislators. And we will bring you some of these reactions as well, of course, as our own opinions. The early days of the session will find the majority and minority parties caucusing to realign their positions, establishing their strategy aims and their programs. It is necessary, particularly in the House of Representatives, for the administration to have a very close control of the vote in order to maintain its policies and enact legislation and tax measures to implement its program. That the administration does have that control was evident during the last session, as a review of the votes on the governor's bills shows that those passing did so on a party line vote, usually in line with the 22 to 18 numerical party division. With this control in both the House and the Senate, and with the so-called freethinkers of the majority practically always going along on the governor's program, the administration has a slim but positive majority and can enact or defeat just about anything it is inclined to pursue. During the entire session of the legislature, we will bring you this daily 5-minute report of actual happenings, timely information, and discussion of legislation of interest to this area. Your minority legislators from this area, Dr. Ed Boggan, Forbes Baker, and Jim Binkley in the House of Representatives, and Paul Grimen of the Senate, will bring you their opinions on pending legislation along with answers to any questions you may have about legislative activities in the state capitol. We want to encourage you to write to us any of us participating in this program in care of the State Capitol Building at Juneau. We'll be very pleased to discuss things requested or answer any questions you may have and any questions you might want discussed on this program. We feel that one of the duties of a legislator is to keep the people informed, and we intend to discharge this duty to the best of our ability. We will be talking to you again from this same station tomorrow at the same time. This has been your Minority Report of the Legislature, Representative Jim Binkley speaking.
The first in a series of Minority Reports from Juneau today featuring Representative Jim Binkley on KFRB 900 in Fairbanks.
Letter of commendation from Mr. and Mrs. Mac Campbell of Hamilton Acres and the part of the city police in recovering their stolen auto last week. After remarking that less than 24 hours lapsed between the time of the theft was reported and the reported return, or rather the property return, the letter concluded, and I quote, "My wife and I want you to know that we have a great deal more respect for the city police after having been in contact with them. Their courteous manner left nothing to be desired, and we wish to extend our thanks to all those people involved," unquote. Also last night, on Mayor Rebar's recommendation, the council reappointed William Stroker, Robert Gray, and Wayne White to the Fairbanks Planning and Zoning Commission. Robert Hates was appointed to the Planning Authority Board, replacing retiring member Edgar Filio, and Mrs. Dorothy Rice was appointed to the Park, Recreation, and Cemetery Commission. Councilman Darrell Brewington read a letter to the council, the Fairbanks Council, at the meeting last night. It was addressed to Representative Frank Chapados, chairman of the State House Finance Committee, from Mr. Corey Howard, director of the State Department of Harbors and Waters. The letter was in reference to possible state participation in a small boat ramp in the Chena River in Fairbanks. The council was informed by Councilman Brewington that the state might go as high as $20,000 in support of such a project. The council instructed the city engineer to send a plat, other required information, and the estimated cost of this project to Representative Chapados, who is now in Juneau attending the state legislature. Six small puppies were lost, and a small shed was completely destroyed at the rear of 1139 First Avenue last night. The Fairbanks Fire Department answered the call at 6:45 p.m. and were unable to save the building or the puppies therein, as the fire was out of control by the time they arrived on the scene. The arrest of two juveniles early this morning appears to have solved numerous open cases of auto theft that have been on the police rolls for the past several weeks. Fairbanks police received a call of the theft of a 1956 Rambler at 12:15 this morning, which had been parked at the Fairlanes Bowl parking lot. Sergeant Nearing of the Fairbanks Police Department apprehended the youth in the car at 15th and Lacey Streets at 12:35 a.m. just 20 minutes later. Youth immediately confessed to the theft of 10 other automobiles. Police report that there might still be others. The motive involved in each case was the desire to go joyriding. The youths are being detained by local juvenile authorities. The Alaska Board of Fish and Game will hold its annual spring meeting in Fairbanks April 5th. Commissioner Walter Kirkness says the board will consider proposals for changes in the state's game and guiding regulations. Senator Bartlett's office says the Department of Welfare is seeking some $34 million from Congress for various Alaska projects in the year starting next July 1st. Some of the projects call for a 12-bed hospital at Barrow, health station at Gamble, sanitation projects at Unalakleet, Yakutat, Kotzebue, and six unnamed locations in the Norton Sound and Hooper Bay areas. Funds for the Arctic Health Research Center at Anchorage also are included. Photographs by 15 Tenino Valley professional photographers are on exhibit at the Alaska Art Gallery in the basement of the Hobby House at 419 2nd Avenue. This exhibition is the first of its kind held in Fairbanks. There are a total of 164 prints depicting various Alaska scenic views, wildlife, portraits, and commercial shots. The showing is open each day from 2 until 5 o'clock and will extend through January 31st.
$70.5 million, with a supplemental request of almost $8 million, giving a total budget in round numbers of about $78 million. This is quite an increase over last year, if you recall. How much is that, by the way? Well, it amounts to $20.5 million over last year, which would be, 35-40% more.
Well, that's certainly a healthy increase, all right. And do you feel that the increase actually is a necessary one, as outlined in the State of the State message by the governor just the other day?
Well, as an individual, I can't say whether it's absolutely necessary or not, but I don't think so. I think that there are a lot of cuts that can be made. I can't possibly see that from 1 year to the next, the expenditure should increase that much.
Well, neither can I, Ed. It seems to me that the attitude that a big state has to have a big budget certainly doesn't fit in our particular instance. I think that some of these programs are going to have to be cut back. Those that are progressive and will produce revenue for the state are the ones that we should drive on. How about your ideas along that line?
Well, I feel the same way. Our population certainly hasn't increased any 40%, and since the same people are here, why, it shouldn't cost any more to...
Certainly not, and the other interesting part of it, Ed, is that the same number of people are going to have to pick up the expense on this thing so that the cost to the people is going to be more, and that brings up something else that comes to my mind right away that it might be worthwhile for us to discuss, and that is about the supplemental request. That used to have another name.
Well, the announcer at noon today on this station, I believe, was referring to the budget message and said that the supplemental appropriations was formerly called the deficiency appropriations. Now, possibly this is more nearly correct.
Well, I think so, too. I noticed that the administration refers to the government now as being streamlined. I suppose this is streamlined language that covers the deficiency. But at any rate, no matter how you say it or how thin you slice it, it still means that they started programs and spent more money last year than they could afford to in the budget. Now it has to be made up. And that brings to my mind, if such is the case, and they are able to bring these deficiency requests to the legislature and get the money, why do we have a budget in the first place?
I certainly can't see any need for a finance committee to study it.
Well, it certainly doesn't seem like logic when they go over the budget and just tell you to pick it up the next year.
That's right.
Well, that's certainly unsatisfactory to me, and it's unsatisfactory to a lot of other people, and we're going to take some very positive action about that. I think it'll be interesting for the people in our area had to know what happens to this budget request that the governor has given us. Here, from this time, it has been given to the Finance Committee, or will be given to them, in the form of a bill. What happens then?
Well, actually, the budget goes to the Finance Committee in the form of a budget, and then we get the appropriations bill and various appropriations bills for the different departments. For example, there's a new department to be formed this year. There's an appropriation for that. There's a so-called supplemental appropriation for the highway department and various things like that. Now, all of these appropriations bills are given to the Finance Committee.
Well, I think it's an interesting thing, Ed, that yesterday afternoon, after the budget message, we received in the House of Representatives 14 separate and distinct supplemental bills, which is money that has to be raised by the legislature to take care of programs that went over the budget last year. I can understand that we're going to have some problems in education, and I'm sure that both of us are sympathetic with that. But there are other areas that this money is being spent that I don't sympathize with. I'm completely displeased, as I know you are, with the road situation. And I'm sympathetic with the investigating committee that's been initiated to look into the activities of the Division of Highways. And what was the amount of money, Ed, that they were deficient this year?
Well, in round numbers, I understand they're asking for $4 million.
That means that they spent $4 million last year that we didn't have, so that we have to come up with it this year. That's almost a very good explanation of deficit spending, and I don't agree with it.
One would suspect that all the construction is going to take place in an election year, and that's why we need the money.
Speaking of that, I'd like to bring this out, Ed. You probably noticed a difference in the attitude of the House of Representatives and many of the members. Just how do you read it this year?
Well, some of the members of the opposite party from the one I belong to have actually approached me and mentioned programs that we had last year and asked if there was any possibility of going along with them, and they've changed their attitude toward things like that.
That is, that the programs that the minority initiated last year that were defeated, and now they feel that we should revive them and try it all over again. That's certainly a change in their attitude.
Yes, having to do, in particular in my case, with organization of the administrative setup in the government.
I certainly hope we can salvage that one and bring it back again. I'll tell you something else that's interesting that happened today, and I know the people at home will be interested in hearing this. The Rules Committee, which controls the flow of work to the floor of the House of Representatives, has been presided over by the chairman, and he has arbitrarily provided the legislature with the bills to act upon which he felt were necessary. In other words, the administration was controlling the work that went to the floor. The bills they didn't want to get into action, they buried. Those they did want passed, they put on the floor. This year, he has taken a turnabout after the minority has been taking a lot of serious actions to change this, and is doing it in a fair and impartial manner by vote, which is the way it should be, and I'm certainly pleased to see that coming about, and it makes you feel better to think that the minority at last is accomplishing something.
I agree with you on that.
Well, Ed, I think that's about it for today. We'll be having another report from the minority from the state capitol here in Juneau. This has been Representative Jim Binkley and
Ed Boggan.
We'll be seeing you again tomorrow at noontime.
The preceding paid political program, Legislative Minority Report, is brought to you each day, Monday through Saturday at 12:15.
Good afternoon, everyone. From the state capitol in Juneau, it's time again for your minority report with Representative Jim Binkley. And today we have from the Senate side of the Capitol building, Senator Paul Grineman. And Paul, I haven't had a chance to see you too much in recent days because I know you've been so busy over there in the Senate. And believe me, I was really surprised to see that body getting down to work so fast this time. Can you tell us a little bit about the activities over on the Senate side of the Capitol building, please, Paul?
Well, let's start this way. Things are really moving along fast this year. It isn't like last year where we went along for a considerable period of time. In fact, I think it was 3 weeks before we ever got a bill and passed it. And on the third day, in the morning, we passed the bill. Yesterday, we had five bills that were on the calendar, of which three were passed, three were sent back into committee, and one Senate joint resolution, and one resolution was again referred back for reconsideration by the committee.
Well, I was certainly glad to see that, Paul. It shows that there's a very serious attitude on the part of the legislators. Not that there wasn't a serious attitude last year, but there was a lot of jockeying around while organization was being made. That brings up something else. Now that everybody has their feet firmly planted on the floor, what do you think about the attitude of the members of the Senate this year as compared to last year?
Well, of course, we're all more settled down. We got acquainted with one another last year and know the working order, and there doesn't seem to be the hassle or the apprehension that we had last year on what's coming up. It seemed like the die has been cut, and we're resolving the situation immediately as they come up without much hassle.
You know, it's an interesting thing, Paul, and you probably feel this as I do, that there's an atmosphere, a sort of an electricity or a chemistry in the air as this thing goes on, and you can almost judge by that just how things are going to go. And I gave an example of this the other day on the change in attitude of the people. As you know, I'm on the very important Rules Committee and the House of Representatives, and it wasn't very important last year because the Rules Chairman arbitrarily decided, and he can do this under the rules, to control the flow of bills that go to the floor all by himself. And I resented this and made my views public. As a matter of fact, I took this gentleman on the House of Representatives several times on this issue, but there was nothing we could do about it. And it seems that the minority is beginning to be felt because this year the Rules Committee is operating and functioning as it should, and we're being consulted on bills that are to go on the floor. As a matter of fact, our opinion is being sought out, and I'm certainly gratified that this has come about. You notice a change of that kind where the minority is being more effective on the Senate side?
Well, that's right. You know, we had problems like that last year, and right away this year, Senator Brad Phillips brought up this calendar, you know, coming out of the Rules Committee. And they wouldn't meet on our desk until the morning when the bills were presented. Didn't give us a chance to review anything. Senator Brad Phillips brought it up, and they promised that they would have the calendar on our desk the night before.
Well, now it has resolved itself that way. I noticed the calendar is very timely, and the calendar is being prepared by a bipartisan group, and I'm certainly pleased to see that happen, Grandin.
That's right. I'm glad to see the cooperation that we're getting this year.
Paul, we had some information on appointment of investigating committees to investigate the activities of a couple of different divisions in the Department of Public Works. There's one committee hearing going on now in preparations for another. One of them originated in the House and the other in the Senate. The investigating committee to look into the activities of the Division of Highways came from your side. Can you give us a little up-to-date information on that one?
Well, not too much has broken on that yet, but I do know that people are dissatisfied. They're grumbling all over the state about the highway program and the lack of constructive programs and progress on the roads in the state. And all members of the Senate were upset about it. It's a bipartisan movement, and that shows a healthy condition. They realize that we've got to get something done on these roads because it's our lifelines in the interior.
Well, I should say it is, and both you and I know that there's been a great deal of dissatisfaction on the part of the people in our district, and I certainly hope that we can get to the bottom of this in this committee.
What'd you do in your airport hearings? What results did you get out of that? As long as we're asking questions, I might ask you that.
Very good, Paul. As you know, the airport investigating committee met yesterday for the first time. We discussed the airport situation with all of the heads of departments, the top echelon of the Division of Airports, and found some very interesting answers to some very pointed questions. I felt a little bit at first that we might be slipping our wheels because one of the senators from the Northwest District was having a personal feud with one of the people on the Division of Airports, and it was getting a little bit rugged over on that side. We managed to calm him down a little bit and conduct it like a decent hearing. And finally, the thing that was established that was most outstanding to me was the fact that there is not too clearly delineated a line of command. In other words, people in the top echelon are not quite sure who's responsible for what. And we're really going to take some means to correct that in a hurry, if such is the case, and it certainly appears that way right now. Paul, you know, I'd like to get back to the budget for just a minute. It hasn't been overworked too much. There's something that was kind of interesting to me, and I know you probably don't remember this, but right after the last session, many people were asked about what they thought the budget would be the following year. Now, I don't know whether you remember what you thought it was going to be, but you came higher than anybody else as you came closer to what the governor presented, and still, yours was way below it.
And when I was consulted with the press on the aspects of the budget, I said, well, I said, the way this thing is, the way this thing seems to be going from the first state legislature up to now, the way that your budget has increased annually, I would predict that the budget presentation for 1962 would be approximately $65 million. And it's gone $5 million over my modest, or my what I thought probably was a little extended as far as an estimate.
Well, I thought that was real interesting, Paul, because you were the one that predicted that they would dip into reserves that we didn't have, probably more than anybody else. And it's interesting to see that even with the very high estimate that you made, if you include the supplementary appropriations, it was $13 million over the top. Would that be?
Yeah, that's right. When you figure the supplementary, that is correct.
Well, I'm going to talk about that supplementary for just a minute here in the closing moments of our program. We had some definitions of supplementary appropriations, and you people in our area, in the Fairbanks area and surrounding environs, are going to be hearing about these supplementary appropriations more and more. I'd like to give you our definition, the minority definition, of a supplementary appropriation. That is, money spent that the administration didn't have, and we must now provide. I'd like to see anyone balance the budget and ease the burden on the taxpayer under those circumstances. How much money must we come up with to cover these so-called overdrafts by the departments and state government? Well, in round numbers, it's just $8 million. It's just like writing a check for $8 million when you don't have the money in the bank. So we've got to come up with it right now. Well, Paul, what's another name for a supplemental appropriation?
Well, it's the first time we have a supplemental appropriation called deficiency appropriation called a supplemental.
Yes, Al, it's inventing new words.
Well, that'll streamline government for you.
Well, thank you, Senator Paul Ryan. It's been real pleasant talking to you here this afternoon. We'll be looking forward to talking to you again tomorrow from the state capitals. You know, this has been your Minority Report.
Unlimited with Reuben Gay.
The following piece gets an occasional call. It's possible that the experiences herein described strike home in memory to some, and we will venture to say that those who have not undergone what is described have not lived entirely. Thus, the big town uses a quaint and familiar phrase to describe him whose string of fortune has run out. The man on the beach. That's the title of this piece. Now, the man on the beach is by no means uncommon. As we remember the crowded competition of the big town, there were at least three men on the beach for everyone who lived on higher ground. And so three out of four were intensely unpopular. There is nothing so despicable as social failure, so bankrupt as the lack of coin of fortune. The man on the beach is usually not there of his own choosing and may even be innocent of the circumstances which put him on the beach. But his presence there is all that matters. He is as much as he who deliberately sells his birthright to live among the pariahs. He may preserve the appearance for a time, but only as long as the funds hold out. From there, he might sustain himself on face alone, but not for long. Some remarkable specimens have weathered a long stretch on the beach and returned to respectability again. No matter what is said and admired about determination in the face of adversity, these returners to grace never again attained the full stature of what they were before they hit the beach. Their memories of the period of bad fortune are so evil that in the future they will compromise anything to hold their respectability. The quality of the work, after all, is nothing compared to the respect of society. So it was, at least in the big town. To be truthful, there is scarcely a man conceived who can hold onto his quality when the beach claims him. The disdain of society gnaws at his self-respect, and once that element is eaten away, he has somehow lost the definition of quality. We will never, so long as we live, understand what Shakespeare meant when he said, "Sweet are the uses of adversity." The passage goes on to reveal that there is likely a precious jewel in the head of an ugly toad. He speaks true when he compares the down-and-outer as an ugly toad, for that is how he regards himself, but there is no jewelry to be found on the beach. We sincerely doubt that anything of any value has ever been learned by him who has undergone the poverty of his fortune and the disdain of society. Nothing beyond resentment and its stronger relative, revenge. It can't even be said that the man on the beach understands the misfortune of his fellow beachcomber. He may gain a certain left-handed comfort from the fact that there are others in his situation, but the only miseries that he can really abide are his own. The other misfortunates are about him, but they are out of focus, since his eyes are turned inward. So it is, at any rate, in the big town where residence on the beach is criminal.